time for Yakety Science.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to Yakety Science, the Tulsa Science Show. We are the program that shines a bright but humorous light into all of the darkest corners of the laboratory, the test tube, and the cyclotron. The show that finds the smirk in your seismology, the snicker in your psychology, the grin in your graminology, the mockery in your mammology, the slapstick in your systematics. I am Brian Cross, Associate Professor of Biology at Tulsa Community College and your humble host. Joining me today are the other members of this week's Yakety Science team. First up, as always, Dr. Matt Smith, Associate Professor of Chemistry at Tulsa Community College. Say hello to the nice people, Matt.
You know, you keep saying that you shine a bright yet humorous light into all the darkest corners of the laboratory, the test tube. The test tube does not have corners.
Mm-hmm. It's true. A simple hello will suffice, Matt. Thank you. And our guest host today is Dr. Chad Johnson. He's an associate professor in the Clinical Mental Health Counseling Program at the University of Oklahoma and a clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at the OU College of Medicine. He will be talking to us today about what has become one of the hottest fields in psychiatry, psychology, which is the use of psychedelics for therapeutic purposes. Chad obviously did not attend any of those DARE sessions that most of us were subjected to, and he missed all of the very special episodes of Different Strokes and never listened to a word that Nancy Reagan said. And so he has fallen afoul of the demon drugs, and he's going to try to share that gospel with us today.
I see it as him, you know, that part in Love Actually, you know, where Bill Nye's character is like, don't buy drugs. Become a psychologist, and they give you them for free.
That's right. Have you found that to be the case?
That they're free?
Yeah.
Not usually.
Yeah. and you brought in some samples, and Matt is obviously already on them here. Is that
feeling
right?
Feeling good.
How are you feeling, Matt?
No drugs were given or used in this podcast.
Our lawyers will thank you for that little tidbit there.
Who would get in more trouble? Would it be you, Chad, or would it be you have all these licensing and things?
A license so it would be, risk.
Yeah. They don't license community college professors. All right. Well, we'll be hearing more about psychedelics a bit later in the show, but for now, what do you say to some headlines?
I'm ready for headlines.
First up, we have more shenanigans from our friends at Colossal Biosciences. We visited them a few episodes ago with the news or with the report or the controversy surrounding the dire wolf de-extinction, and they are back in the headlines now. They have drawn in Peter Jackson of Lord of the Rings fame here, a famous New Zealander, and they have
cloned him?
They have not cloned him, but they are at least announcing this effort to sequence the genome of the giant moa. The moas were these massive flightless birds.
I believe we already have this. It's called the ostrich.
Well, the ostrich is actually a big bird, but it is not as big as the moa. So the ostrich, a male ostrich at the kind of top of the range is going to be about 3 meters. These guys, the moas at the top of their range are about 3.6 meters, and they're bigger, stockier birds. These were native to New Zealand. There were 9 species of moas, and they went extinct a few hundred years ago when the Polynesians arrived. So the Polynesians arrived, and they found this flightless bird that was big and meaty, and they quickly turned it into dinner. And so it was quickly eliminated from the islands, but they estimate about 150 years after the Polynesians arrived. The idea that Colossal has here is, again, cast in this sort of messianic goal of restoring biodiversity. But really, they've picked another one of these species that is charismatic megafauna, kind of a design to catch headlines, I think. That seems to be what they're really good at, is sort of picking species and publicizing it and doing the PR work to make sure that they are the center of conversation. And we are falling right into their trap by leading the headlines with discussions of the MOA. Anyway, this is very early stages at this point. There has been some controversy about, like, do the Maori of New Zealand really support it? Some of them seem to. Others seem to be against the extinction. So there have been some issues around MOA appropriation, if I could phrase it that way. So anyway, you guys have any thoughts?
So for the dire wolves, we're not sure if they have de-extincted the dire wolves officially yet or not. But
I think we're pretty sure that what they did was fiddle with a gray wolf and put a few dire wolf traits into a gray wolf.
And isn't this basically what they're doing with the MOA as well?
They haven't gotten to that point yet. They're still at the point of sequencing the MOA. It's not clear what other species they're going to use, because usually when you're doing de-extinction, you've got the ancient DNA sequence, and then you're kind of piecing that together with an extant species. The closest extant species, I believe, is it a tinamou? I think it's a tinamou, and it's a really tiny little thing. So I'm not sure if they're going to use that.
Well, if Peter Something Jackson else? Has anything to do with it, then I expect to see this whole de-extinction of the MOA into a 3 movies when it should have only been 1. We're going to have extended editions.
It's going to be a Thanksgiving movie.
Absolutely.
Look what's on the table this Thanksgiving.
That's right.
Were humans involved in the extinction of the direwolf? Can we blame humans for that? Because we can blame humans for the extinction of the MOA.
I think it's less clear. I mean, there are lots of prehistoric creatures that, yes, we did drive to extinction. I don't know about the direwolf specifically, though.
My thought, which I think you guys have covered in your Jurassic Park and other things, is that problem of introducing. I mean, if it's just a science experiment, like, look, here's a new one, or if they're trying to reintroduce and revive, that's messing with ecology. Mm-hmm. And that's a big problem we have as human beings, is we think we're managing animal management, and then we make things worse. Mm-hmm. We introduce this species, it wipes out another one.
The MOA has been gone. The dire wolf has been gone for a long period of time. As I've heard one paleontologist say, the waters close very quickly around a species when it goes extinct. Other species adjust their niches. Other introductions have happened since. You know, the ecology has adjusted to the absence of it, and it may not be. You know, in some cases, you might say that, hey, it's not as healthy as it was before, but you also don't know what the effect is going to be of going back. And you can't necessarily put Humpty Dumpty back together again once it's been shattered. So
that's my concern. Humans particularly bad at actually predicting the consequences of our meddling.
True, yeah. Yeah. And then at the same time, the scale of our destruction seems to call for a bold response. And so you want to respond, but at the same time, you don't want your response to become worse.
One thing that fascinates me is the ethics of who's making the choices of what we de-extinct. That's really fascinating. Like, why and how and why? Speciesism. Like, why this one and not that one?
Right, yeah. Yeah, and it tends to be the things that we think are cool. I mean, that's clearly the approach of classical bias.
Coolness, the coolness
like
factor.
Woolly mammoth and dire wolves. I think just the name dire wolf alone got them to that one. The MOA, giant birds, right? So they're not like finding an obscure species of mayfly that has gone extinct, and they're trying to bring that back.
This is how you secure your funding and your sponsorship.
That's true. Yeah,
with some big flashy things at the start, so that then you can move into the less popular, darker side.
Yeah. Well, when Colossal Biosciences moves on to the mayflies, I will eat crow at that point. But any other thoughts?
I'm out of thoughts.
You're out of thoughts?
Yeah. My thoughts are
You've emptied your brain.
More MOA. Right. More MOA.
More MOA. More problems.
That's more MOA, more problems. That's what I always say.
All right.
Okay, and now it's time to revisit an old friend on Yakety Science. A few episodes ago, we introduced you to the Parker Solar Probe. That's right. This is a probe that was launched by NASA in like 2018, and it makes these large elliptical sort of orbits around the sun. And, well, we just got some new pictures from the Parker Solar Probe.
Around the sun and Venus, right?
So that's right. Around the sun and Venus. It's making these huge loops. Huge loops.
That's right. And in December, about December 24th, it came, it made its closest pass, which was about 3.8 million miles from the solar surface.
And it sent back some interesting images and video of solar wind. And you can see these, we'll link to them in our show notes, and you can also see them on NASA's website.
Chad, have you seen the pictures?
Just recently I did. I saw some of the pictures, and it's remarkable. Yeah. It's wild.
Had you heard of this Parker Solar Probe before today?
Not that I remember.
Yeah, it's amazing. These projects that do these, you know, first ever things, first ever sort of look at the atmosphere of the sun at this scale and so on. And it just kind of floats above the national consciousness. And people just aren't aware of it unless they're space nerds, you know.
I'm sure the headline passed by me, but
yeah, it probably did. Yeah,
didn't.
Yeah.
And it's pretty sad. That's something that's great about this podcast is you bringing this kind of consciousness and awareness back to science. And
$20 for saying that. Where's my wallet?
Non-paid sponsor right there, or non-paid advertisement.
What else would you say is great about our podcast?
Matt's one of the best parts. Probably the best part.
The second best. That you probably would say the second best.
No, I wouldn't say that. Do we know how close we have to get to burn up? Like it stayed 3.8 million miles away, and that's the closest.
Yeah. No, I didn't say that. The temperatures are very intense at that point. They're actually more intense there than they are at the surface of the sun, which is one of the mysteries they're trying to work out, trying to understand. They're trying to understand this solar wind. They're trying to understand this sort of weird kind of temperature anomaly where the surface of the sun, I believe, is a lower temperature than actually this zone.
Than the corona, yeah. And, of course, then the core is stupidly hot. Yeah. Than anything. So it's like hot and then cold and then hot again.
Next up, we have a new way of potentially boosting math skills among those who struggle with that topic. There are many, many people out there that find themselves tearing their hair out in math classes. We certainly have that phenomenon here at TCC. And this is a new method for potentially helping those students. This is a direct intervention that is called transcranial random noise stimulation, which involves using magnets to stimulate electrical currents in different parts of the brain. It's a specific kind of a broader phenomenon called transcranial magnetic stimulation. And so this has been used. I think you may know something about this, Chad. This has been used in the past to treat things like OCD. Do you have any experience with that?
Not personally, but right. It's one of our cutting edge technologies working on OCD, depression, a substitute, a non-invasive way versus like the electroconvulsive therapy, which is still around, still being used in really severe cases of depression. But this is non-invasive,
and it's kind of
had some good success.
And it's a more gentle sort of stimulation of the brain than
not so shocking.
That's very good. All right. So what they did was stimulate particular parts of the brain. So they divided students up. These students were in the 18 to 30 range. They were university students, and they took them and divided them up into a group that received a placebo, and then a group that was treated with this TRNS. Transcranial random noise stimulation. They stimulated particular parts of the brain to induce more connectivity, right? So more activity between like the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex and other parts of the brain. And so they were stimulating these different parts of the brain, and they saw a measurable effect following the treatment. And this gives us hope, perhaps, of dealing with what has become a big problem, which is that students that start off doing well in math continue to excel, and they continue to do better and better. And then those who start off maybe a little bit behind, they fall further and further behind as we go along. There's a name for it. I can't remember. What's the name for it?
Is it the Chad effect?
Of the falling behind in math, where there's this sort
of widening
gap.
The Brian effect?
Right?
The Brian effect, I think it is.
I don't think that is. There's something that's more apt. Here it is. It's the Matthew effect.
Oh, it is. It's the Matthew effect. And I wondered at first, is the Matthew referring to those who are good with math skills and just get better and better? Or was the Matthew named after someone who was poor at math and just did worse and worse?
I think it was named after someone who fell farther and farther behind.
It is neither. Actually, it is actually named after the book Matthew in the Bible.
Oh, really?
Yeah, in the book of the Matthew says, you know, to those who have, more will be given. To those who have less, you know, even that will be taken away. It's that whole, you know, the rich get rich.
richer and the poor get poorer. And that's the idea behind this math. Okay. You know, those who start off and do well in math just get better and better and better. Because what they believe, when you get good at math, that's because you're forming more connections between different parts of the brain.
And you build upon that.
And then you just build upon that. You get better and better and better. And those who don't do that, well, then they're just not making those connections and they just fall behind. Yeah. Well, with this, you know, transcranial random noise stimulation, their belief is that they are, just by kind of getting this random noise in there, they're helping stimulate more connections within the brain, which helps kind of kickstart these kids into getting better at math.
This could be the next frontier of psychedelic science, too, where we, you know,
combine the two?
Yeah, take some LSD and see how your math scores go.
Oh, there you go.
How about we take some LSD and zap our brains with magnets?
Ooh.
And then take some
double
bath.
Your fun.
Yes.
Yeah. I have a feeling that it's not going to be conducive to to performing.
Probably not while you're
maybe
on
post
LSD,
post-trip,
but,
maybe.
But the increased connectivity, that is one of the things that psychedelics are contributing, right. Yeah. That neuroplasticity is increased, right. Potential there for being better at math. Yeah. Maybe.
It's a wonderful start.
It's a bold hypothesis, right? We await the empirical proof.
We await the studies. We'll
the
sign
kids will
up.
Be excited about that one, though.
They will.
Magnets or shrooms?
I think you'll have trouble.
Why not both?
I think you'll have trouble selling that to the Tulsa School Board. I think you might have trouble selling
not
that.
Not to mention the Human Subjects Board. Yeah. So we're going to give minors drugs. For math.
For math.
That's right. All right. Next up, we have the answer to our last sound science puzzler. For those of you who did not hear that or do not remember it, here it is again. All right, so that was the little whoop, whoop sound. And that is the gravitational wave detected by LIGO, that is the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, detected by LIGO, rendered as sound, but it's the gravitational waves associated with two black holes colliding. So that was the correct answer. That is the sound of two black holes colliding. It was not, as Matt suggested, the sound of our two egos colliding, nor did it have anything to do with your truly massive bow tie. It was just two black holes.
This simply is a normal, respectable bow tie size.
Yes. Well, it's got to be, it's got to be like, I don't know, 5 or 6 feet across
it
there.
It is not. No clown bow tie.
The listeners will just have to trust me. This is a truly giant bow tie that he's wearing here. I mean, I don't know how he finds these.
The wingspan of an albatross.
That's right. All right. Well, congratulations to those who got this one correct, and we'll have a brand new sound science puzzle for you up later in the show.
Totally natural thing in it. It's totally natural thing in it. It's totally natural thing in it. It's.
Next up, we have Matt's Chemical Minute, a segment lasting 5 to 7 decades. Matt is going to tell us about an element, a compound, or some other chemical entity that we should care about. He will then give this entity a rating of 1 to 5 stars. I will listen and then potentially argue with Matt about his rating. Today, Matt takes up another key element, that is oxygen, atomic number 8. Matt, I am used to you sucking the oxygen out of the room, but I'm hoping that today you will be filling the room with your knowledge of this critical element.
Oxygen. Surely you mean phlogiston, do you not?
Surely I don't.
Surely you don't. Are you saying that you are not an alchemist?
I'm saying that my knowledge of chemistry has moved on since the Middle
Ages. 1703?
That's right.
Yeah, so phlogiston theory was an early attempt by alchemists to explain combustion. This came from Johann Becker, who gave us such bangers as Physica Subterranea, which is all matters composed of air, water, and 3 different earths. So we have like Terra Lapidae, Terra Fluidia, and Terra Pinguis. Well, Pinguis is is related to combustibility, flammability. So it's Terra Pinguis that George Ernst Stahl took ahead and inflated it into this phlogiston theory. Phlogiston was supposed to be this... material that's not a material, but it's a component of all matter, but not really its own thing. A phlogisticated substance is something that has the capacity to burn, to combust. So if something can be burned, it is phlogisticated, and by burning, that phlogiston is leaving the substance, leaving it dephlogisticated as ash or calx or something.
I feel phlogisticated.
I feel kind of flagellated at this point, leaving out phlogiston.
Yeah.
It makes no sense. It's like, so a solid or liquid that can burn?
It makes perfect sense.
Oh, sure.
Within its own terms, it makes perfect sense. It just doesn't happen to explain all observations. How did they discover that this was not right?
Oh, thankfully, this was in 1771 by our boy. Who's our boy?
Lavoisier.
That's right, Antoine Lavoisier.
Never forget.
That's right. Oh, poor guy. Died in the French Revolution, but gave us the gift of oxygen. So he did an experiment in 1771 where he took some tin and he combusted it inside a sealed container and showed that the mass before and after combusting is the same. So no matter was lost. And yet when he opened the canister, air rushed in. Mm-hmm. So air must have been taken away. And the tin, which is now tin oxide, weighed more, and it weighed the amount. The mass gained by tin becoming tin oxide was equal to the mass of the air that rushed into the container. So he showed that, combustion was a substance. The act of combustion was pulling in a substance. In this case, tin was pulling in some element, and that element was oxygen.
Excellent.
Yes. Antoine Lavoisier and gave us oxygen through tin oxide. Do you know what other genius, brilliant chemist also used tin oxide in their dissertation?
I had a suspicion, but when you use the word genius, then I was... Is it you, Matt?
It is me. That's right. It's a connection between me and Antoine Lavoisier. We are as one. Okay, so actual oxygen facts, then? Do you want some actual oxygen facts?
I would like useful oxygen facts.
I mean,
facts,
I
yes.
guess so. Fine. I mean, so... Okay, so the oxygen is the most abundant element on Earth. It is like 46% of the Earth's crust. Mm-hmm. And you're like, what? It's only like 21% of the atmosphere. Yeah, no. It's in all of rock and sand. All of rock and sand is made of, silicate molecules.
Yeah, dioxide.
Silicon dioxide and the silicate ion, which is SiO4. More oxygen you see is in the solid form as a mineral than it is actually in the atmosphere.
Right.
Your body, you are 65% oxygen by mass because you are mostly water, and water is mostly oxygen.
But you're also carbohydrates, and you're also proteins, and all those biological macromolecules, most of them anyway, have a lot of oxygen in them.
That's true.
If we're called an airhead, that's actually not an insult, just a fact.
It is a fact.
Well, you're equating air with oxygen.
That's true.
See, you try to make a joke, and he just slaps you down. He's the only one who's
this
allowed
is
to be
Yakety
funny.
I'm going to slap it down in the most pedantic way possible.
Absolutely.
Well, actually, Chad.
Gosh.
All right. What else should we know about oxygen? Why do I breathe in oxygen?
It helps you combust things.
Yeah.
And what is combustion inside the body? That's called cellular respiration.
That's
you
right,
need
yes.
oxygen. So you breathe in air to get that oxygen so that you can basically burn your carbohydrates for energy.
Many of our listeners probably learned the phrase powerhouse of the cell without any context whatsoever. But carbohydrates are the fuel of the powerhouse of the cell. And it's the oxygen allows you to dephlogisticate the...
There we go.
The carbohydrates.
Fantastic. So other allotropes of oxygen that we like are, of course, ozone, O3, the ozone molecule, which we have a very small layer of up in the atmosphere and helps block out harmful UV radiation.
Yeah. Oxygen isotopes are, if you get into past climates and trying to chart the temperature of the Earth, oxygen isotopes are really important for that. So
that's true. Yeah. Specifically, it's the difference between oxygen 16 and oxygen 18. Mm-hmm. Most oxygen is oxygen 16. So there's always a small amount of oxygen 18 out there in the water. But when the temperature is, so it's a little bit heavier. So therefore, it does actually freeze at a slightly lower temperature than normal water.
I think this is so fascinating to someone.
Chad, you Philistine. Well, I think we need a rating, Matt.
We do, and I have to say, my love for oxygen, my love for Antoine Lavoisier, kind of has to put me rating oxygen around a 4 or a 5. 4.5. So you introduced, fractional ratings here. So
I did. Well, I'm going to go with the whole number this time, though, because I don't want to offend Oxygen. I depend heavily on Oxygen. Even though entropy would argue that all of the oxygen molecules in this room probably will not gather in the corner up there and suffocate me to death, it's possible they could. I don't want to offend them, so I'm going to give them 5 stars.
Easy 5 for me.
Easy 5. Yeah. Okay. So
without them, I wouldn't be here to rate them.
Yeah. So 5 plus 5 plus 4.5
is 14.5 divided by 3 is 4.83.
4.83. Okay. So the rating for Oxygen is 4.83. We will record that in the
history books.
In the big book of elements. Thank
Let
you, Matt.
Be written.
You did indeed fill the room with knowledge. Next up, we have our interview with Dr. Chad Johnson. He has been a practicing therapist for 20 years and has, in recent years, become interested in psychedelics as therapeutics. So can you tell me a little bit about that, Chad? How did you get involved with this topic?
Yes, certainly. It began for myself with a personal experience, as it probably has done for most of the people in the field. I was in my late 20s in Tennessee, and some psychology friends introduced me to MDMA. So I had...
Got to be wary of those graduate students. They're hard-partying graduate psychology students.
Yep. I had a whole other story was I was going through a real crisis of sort of religious, spiritual time. And so I had never done any drugs up to that point. I was in my late 20s. Nothing more than a beer or whiskey every once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
So very pure lungs, very pure brain, like very square. And in that, it was significant because that crisis of faith was like I was experiencing deep grief and depression. Like it just sort of lost that religious foundation that I had, my worldview, just everything. So it was really crumbling. I really felt this floating emptiness. And they said, well, we have something for you. We have some medicine for you that might help you see things differently.
Did they use quotation marks when they...
Some medicine. And so I was like, why not? And I was very nervous, very scared, but it blew me away. The mind-heart opening experience. Now, MDMA are not traditional psychedelics. There wasn't a lot of hallucinations kind of things, but... Mm-hmm. But lights were brighter, feelings were way more intense than anything I'd ever experienced before. I remember looking at this in the eyes of, with all sincerity, this total stranger saying, I see God. And, just pure, as they used to call it, ecstasy, right? And it was. And that was amazing. So that started my journey. It was just something not just cool. It was, I felt transformed.
Mm-hmm.
Like a pair of glasses were dropped and I got a new pair and just saw the world very differently.
Yeah, and that seems to be, that's one of the tricky parts about this topic for me, coming at it from a science point of view, is that, many of the psychedelic advocates like, Rick Doblin of MAPS has a very expansive view of the benefits of psychedelics. It's not just a therapeutic treatment, but it's also the consciousness raising that is going to remake the world and so on. Does the blurring of the lines kind of between science and mysticism and mind expansion and so on, does it make it difficult to do good science? Is it more prone to confirmation bias? Is it more prone to kind of boosterism?
It's a great question, and it is a very important question. As we all know, first of all, just culturally trying to advocate and move forward with this research with these with psychedelics has a lot. It's an uphill battle given our war on drugs history and the culture wars and all these other things. So that was a real reason why Rick Doblin, and he wasn't smart enough when many others like him, to say if we want to get this forward in the culture, we need science to back this up. Mm-hmm. And that's a line that's been – there's a tension and a line that's been difficult to watch there because a lot of the advocates and believers have also experienced it and have recognized personal, transformative, transcendent types of experiences these medicines can facilitate. It's hard to sort of stay a sober-minded, objective scientist while you're having these incredibly psycho-spiritual, mystical experiences and seeing the power of those. So to answer your question shortly, it's like, yes, it is difficult. It is a challenge. In fact, there's been some criticism recently of one of the great minds and great researchers, Roland Griffiths, who passed away recently. But he's been criticized for being too much of a sort of a religious guru advocate for that spiritual piece and maybe compromise some of his research. You know, it's questionable, but it's possible that has happened. And so that is something that we try to walk that line, trying to be careful of the confirmation bias, not only the researchers, but what we're conveying and communicating to participants that are involved in this. Because there is a lot of hype, and I like to be a spokesperson that's more balanced and not getting run away with hype. There's a lot of potential here, but it's also there's risks, and for some, this doesn't work at all.
What kind of data can you collect in this? Is it mostly like anecdotal for these studies, or is there a quantifiable like thing you can measure to say this is helping, this is not helping?
Mm-hmm. There's multifaceted, so there's a lot of neurobiological research going on, everything from your brain scans and your, you know, biochemical analyses. So they're addressing it that way from the biology and chemistry side, trying to understand what is this doing to our brains. And it's still quite mysterious. Like there's some indicators and pointers to what's going on there, but there's a lot we don't know and understand. The best description I've heard is they're non-specific amplifiers in your neurobiology. They just seem to flood it with a bunch of neurotransmitters and just do all kinds of magical things that aren't magical. They are, you know, there's going to be a science to it and an objective understanding, but it is quite complicated.
Right. There's at least some knowledge, isn't there, of which receptors within the brain are being affected. Some of them are affecting serotonin receptors.
Right.
Some of them are affecting glutamate receptors and so on. So
there is some
knowledge of what specifically is being activated.
There is. That's one of the exciting things. Now that since the, you know, after the 70s, it shut down all the research. By the way, there were decades of research going on, you know, on psychedelics, therapeutically and otherwise. 1970, Nixon's, whatever that,
War
on drugs statute he wrote, you know, shut it all down, and it was gone for decades. Started to come around again in the 90s and then really built momentum in the 2000s to today. Now we have the legality to do this research, so there is some really exciting neurobiological,
So they're all, or almost all of these drugs that we're talking about here, and we're talking about things like psilocybin, we're talking about MDMA. Mm-hmm. The only one I think that's approved for sort of general therapeutic use is ketamine. Is that correct? So, but these others are being used in clinical trials. They have sort of limited approval for use in clinical trials.
To answer your question was just that. The one branch is the biological mechanisms, but clinical trials with control groups, objective measures of behavioral change.
Comparing a placebo group to a treatment group.
That's one of the big challenges of clinical research, though, of course, because it's hard not to notice if you've taken psilocybin and you're tripping. It's hard to find a placebo that will, you know.
Is the placebo really a placebo if you know whether you've taken it or not? So they had this big trial, the Lykos Therapeutics a trial with MDMA. That seems to be the one that's gotten closest to approval for therapeutic use, for general therapeutic use. But that was rejected. Was that last year or the year before?
Correct,
it was rejected.
Last summer.
And I think some of the FDA, some of the concerns they raised related to kind of bias in the in the results. Can you speak to that or to, you know, where what the status of that is now?
Yes. So that was a big blow. There was a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of hype, a lot of excitement. The FDA did say, hold on, we're not ready to approve this yet, and did say go back to the drawing board, at least that third tier of trials to get some more data. I mean, that was one of the controversies. There was some criticism of some misbehavior on the part of some clinician, you know, researchers, and it was only a few. I mean, these are very rare. These are thousands and thousands of participants, but there was some of that, which is concerning and shouldn't be happening. This is also controversial because there's some political stuff going on here too, we think. You know, there was some lobbyists that are trying to stop and prevent this from happening that some say had some influence with these FDA and committees and so on. Some of these committees had known conflicts of interest with other psychiatry and other kinds of things like that. So there was some controversy of how objective and open the FDA panel, not the FDA itself, actually, was the committee that the task force that actually gave its first disapproval. So there was some controversy about, not about the medicines themselves. These were some inappropriate behavior in some of the trials or one trial. And essentially just, yeah, wanting to kind of slow down and back up and say, let's really make sure that this is safe. Also, another, I will say, another one of the major issues was the therapeutic component being attached to it.
Okay.
The FDA said, we're a drug, you know, even though, by the way, this was all approved by the FDA before they started these trials.
Right.
So that was another frustration, was like, we talked about this with you guys.
So just to back up a little bit, what you're talking about here is you, so someone will take a dose of MDMA and then they'll meet with the therapist to talk through the experience, and that is part of the treatment, kind of the standard treatment.
The trials, yes, they would take MDMA with therapists, two therapists, in a controlled setting, in a video recorded setting, and experience the MDMA with facilitators that would be there for their safety and to guide them through the experience as they were having it. Mm-hmm. Also included preparation sessions and integration sessions afterwards. Those are really key components, we believe, for really ethical, competent, effective psychedelic-assisted therapy and work.
And so were they saying then also that, like, they couldn't, you couldn't separate the effects of the therapy from the drugs that were being administered? Is that?
Basically, yes. They kind of balked when it came down to it to wanting to approve something that it required the inclusion of therapy.
Oh, okay.
Of course, the therapy world is like, well, we really want that. We're afraid of that. That very thing, just sort of biomedical science, just saying we're just going to use this as our medicines and our ways. Screw any behavioral interventions. Right. Maybe you can't, I shouldn't say screw it. put aside any actual behavioral, therapeutic, mental health intervention and support. You know, once again, let's just give them a drug and hope it has a good effect.
Okay. Let's zero in on some of the disorders that have seemed most amenable to treatment with psychedelics. I think PTSD has been one that's at the top of the list.
Yeah. So to their credit, again, these early researchers, they didn't start with sort of just simple things. They really wanted to show its effect and believe it had an effect on some of the most difficult things. So there have been things like trauma and PTSD, which is notoriously difficult to treat with medically or therapeutically. That was one of the reasons, like, start with that. You know, MDMA for PTSD does have very strong effects. And so this is a, you know, there's such a high degree of trauma and need for this. This could be a really ground breakthrough kind of therapy treatment for people who are suffering. Treatment-resistant major depressive disorder is another one.
Substance abuse
disorder. Substance abuse and addiction is a big one. And that was also true. All these were true in the 60s and 70s. They were using these, using psychedelic medicines to, in fact, the founder of AA, Bill Johnson, attributed a great deal of his success and sobriety to his LSD experiences. That's, you know, that's a recorded fact. Like, that's not often mentioned in AA meetings, that he actually took LSD a few times under a therapeutic, you know, intervention that helped him reach his sobriety. And another really important one is end-of-life and palliative care. Using psychedelic medicine and having that experience for people facing, you know, deep anxiety and distress around end-of-life issues. So that's been another major one with really positive results.
Chad, in the last episode, we discussed the hit movie Lucy.
Do you know of anyone who has used psychedelics to successfully unlock the other 90% of their brain that apparently we don't use?
Yes, I'm so glad you asked that. Besides, of course, as I know you're saying that tongue-in-cheek, is that's not true at all. But that is one of the things I do want to emphasize, because you mentioned the controversy or some of the, you know, scientifically trying to approach these spiritual subjects. And arguably, one of the most spiritual in some people's minds is consciousness itself. What is it? Where does it come from? How does it work? That's one of the exciting, you know, forefronts of psychedelic medicine, is what it might be teaching us and the doors it might be unlocking to understand consciousness itself. That it's far beyond what we've ever thought, you know, that these doors of perception being blown apart. And so that's really exciting. So while we want to bring a scientific lens to it and find ways to ethically and scientifically understand these medicines and the effects they have, the potential they have for healing and growth, I am a big advocate for psycho-spiritual development and personal growth itself, regardless of any disorder. So I understand the need for clinical science and, you know, clinical trials, and it opens the door as we see it as a healing medicine, but I'm an advocate for personal and spiritual growth. I'm also fascinated by consciousness studies and what it is, and this, I think this is one of the great you know, entryways into understanding consciousness.
Right. Yeah, but just to echo that, I mean, the important thing is that you keep Guru Chad separate from Scientist Chad. That's
right. I keep them in dialogue, though, right? Because anything a mystic or a guru may be doing, well, we might not be able to access at this point into your consciousness to see what's going on. We certainly, you know, that's what psychology has always sought to do. It's like there's grand claims, you know, deserve grand evidence. So how, you know, I love the empiricist spirit of William James. Like, we can observe and do our best to understand. We can't necessarily understand what spirit is, but we can certainly see its effects, right?
Right.
And
the thing that is the thing that is so difficult is that is so much of it is subjective, and science demands the objective, right, as we kind of move towards a common understanding of something. But so much of what it appears that people gain from it is subjective and kind of non-transferable. You know, it's kind of almost impossible to communicate. You know, if you have an experience that's beyond words, how do you, you know, and if nobody else can verify that experience, right, it just is inherently very challenging for science to deal with. So, Chad, you've just returned from the Psychedelic Science Conference in Denver. This is one that was hosted by the MAPS group. This is the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies.
Correct.
I got that right?
You got
yes.
it.
Excellent.
You got
right.
it.
I need a ribbon for that.
It's
so,
a mouthful.
What insights did you gain from your time there in the Mile High City, the High City?
Major conference in the world. As the, by the way, the researchers in this is impressive list of a resume, right? It's New York University, Harvard, Stanford, UT Austin.
And looking at the website, it looked like there were quite a lot of the guru spiritual leaders that were there as well, too.
There
so
were.
There's that side of it.
That's one takeaway.
Yeah. That's the multidisciplinary part, I guess.
That's one takeaway. And that's one of the challenges to this gaining legitimacy and balancing also the spiritual, psycho-spiritual, and you know, in respectful dialogue with religion and other things. It does attract it. Like, I saw both. Like, there was your academics in bow ties, and there was your, you know, colorful hair,
shaman-type
robes flowing all in the same place, which is fascinating. There was 4,000 people there.
Yeah.
One of the largest conferences in psychedelics in the world. That was what was impressive. But it does bring these disparate, you know, avenues of folks with different interests and into psychedelics. So it's a fascinating world. We do, again, want to do it responsibly. We saw what happened when people get frightened and scared by this. Government shuts it down and sets us back again. I truly believe, and the research so far is bearing this out, there is great potential for healing in ways we have not yet experienced. And they're blowing the doors off the findings that they have for, like, SSRIs and other kinds of medicines and talk therapy in itself. The outcomes are outstanding, like crazy outstanding, like doubling and tripling the effects of our standard treatment. So great potential here, but we do need to be cautious and need to slow down a bit and also tamper down the hype.
Yeah, the hype tends to take over, doesn't it? All right. Well, thank you, Chad. This has been, shall I say, mind-altering conversation. We appreciate your time.
I appreciate being here. It was fun.
Ironikos prosphilos eleluth.
Up next, we have our new sound science puzzler. In this segment, I will challenge you to identify a science-related sound. It could be the sounds made by an animal, physical phenomenon, or it could be something that is associated with science in some other way. Here is your new sound science puzzler. Listen to the following. Okay, that's it. That is your sound science puzzler for this week. What is responsible for that sound? I'm not going to give you any clues. One more time. All right, that's it. If you think you know the right answer,
or even if you have just a guess, a wild stab in the dark, share that with us. Send it into yakityscience@gmail.com and make sure to include your name, your phone number, social security number, date of birth, and your mother's maiden name. All of those bits of information would be much appreciated. Well, that's it for this episode of Yakety Science. As always, we leave you with a wise, wise quote, this time from a romantic poet of note. This week's quote comes from William Blake's The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, in honor of our guest. If the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite. For man has closed himself up till he sees all things through narrow chinks of his cavern. With those humbling words, we leave you, dear listener, until the next episode of Yakety Science. Thanks for joining us. Thanks, Matt. Thanks, Chad.
My pleasure. Happy to be here. Good times.
Yakety Science is produced, written, and edited by Matt Smith and Brian Cross. Production help provided by Scott Gregory. Theme music by Lobo Loco. Yakety Science is recorded at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa and at the Center for Creativity at Tulsa Community College. If you'd like to yak back at us, our email is yakityscience@gmail.com. We love to hear from you.
Wait, they don't love you like I love you. Wait, they don't love you like I love you. Maps.